a clear transmission.
Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Send a clear transmission.
Some people were warning us that the British movement was going to show up tonight. Beat the fuck out everyone because they don't like the Redskins. Don't like Americans because we're not people, only you are people. Ha ha, we're all people. What happens in America affects you. What happens here affects us. This is not an anti-skinhead song, an anti-Mohican song, or an anti-hippie song, or nothing. It's what's inside your head that counts. This is an anti-racist song. Anti-fighting song. Who the fuck came here for a brawl, anyway? In America, there's words for people like that. It's called redneck. Nazi rednecks, fuck you!
Enough Nazi punks for one evening.
Divide and rule is one of the oldest means of mass control. Standard practice since at least the Roman Empire. This is applied at the level of modern imperialism, where each small nation competes with others for capital investments. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles. The regime can sit on the sidelines, intervening covertly to stir things up or guide them in desired directions. In this way, most discontent can be neutralized and force can be reserved for exceptional cases. The covert guiding of various social movements has proven to be one of the most effective means of programming factions and stirring them against one another. Fundamentalist religious movements have been particularly useful. They have been used not only within the U.S., but also to maximize divisiveness in the Middle East and for other purposes throughout the empire. The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000.
Hello, you're listening to Sheffield Indie Radio's second podcast, Deportations, the EDL, and Divide and Rule. That was Lynn Gary of Unwelcome Guests.
Now here you come, baby.
The podcast started with a shout out to all those of the right wing persuasion, you know the Dead Kennedys, Nazi punks, fuck off.
What you don't know, baby. She'll give me the blues.
Okay, here's Old Boy to give us a rundown on the show.
All right, coming up on the show this month, we'll be kicking off with listings from Alt Sheffield. Bob over there from Alt Sheffield giving us the listings. We'll take a look at two Sheffield anti-deportation campaigns with audio from a meeting that happened in Sheffield and a demo outside the UK border agencies. Then there'll be a section on the Deepwater Horizon BP oil spill. An interesting bit on the EDL, and I'm sure we'll be talking a bit about that later. Kicking off with a bit from the man himself, Alan Lake. And then after that, we'll be crossing the invisible line with 2%. Then we'll be doing our renowned, I think, well, one person said it was good, bollocks chat towards the end. And then at the end, a 10-minute mix from me. Yeah, that's programme number two. Okay, it's that time again. Old boy here from Sheffield Indie Radio Collective. I'm here again with Bob from Alt Sheffield. Hello,
hello
Bob.
Hello.
Oh, you all right? We're going to, as we did in the last podcast, just do a run through of the listings for activities that are going on late July through to August. Bob, what's going on?
Okay, well, interesting things happening around Sheffield area. Over in Barnsley, they've got a new freecycle group. Well, it's actually called Freegal, a breakaway from Freecycle, if you don't know what that is. Details on the Alt Sheff website, or links on there, of course. Rotherham Freegal group is pretty active. They've just come up with a new message posting system on theirs. Yeah, going around the country, there's all sorts of things happening through August. We've got Earth First, Camp for Climate Action, an animal rights summer gathering, and various peace things down south in Berkshire, Trident Ploughshares, and a protest at the atomic weapons establishment at Aldermaston.
I went to that a couple of 3 or 4 years ago. Really good, really good.
Yep.
Interesting people.
Yeah, yeah. These are people who've been in a certain movement for 20 years and more, aren't they?
Yeah,
so very experienced and good to learn from them, yeah.
Mm.
Okay, well, Alt Sheff's got all the usual monthly listings, so I'm not going to go through each one day by day, but I would like to highlight the various community festivals that are happening around Sheffield during August. Community festivals aren't necessarily political, but I think in a world that's becoming increasingly commercialised, it is worth getting involved in your local community. It's a place to take stalls, to speak to people.
Mm.
So, Aberdale Industrial Hamlet celebrates the Lammas Festival on the 8th of August, the welcoming of the first grain harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Never been to that before.
Yeah, never have.
Norton Show on the 15th, Low Edges Festival on the 15th, sorry, Norton Show on the 14th, Low Edges Festival on the 15th, Hackenthorpe Gala on the 21st, and Sheffield Fair, I guess that's a bit more of a commercial one, but that's on the 29th and 30th of August. Various other interesting things happening. There's a Green Woodwork and Nature's Remedies weekend at the end of July in a secret location near Sheffield. That's the Mysterious Pixies. If you want to find out more, contact details are on the Alt Sheff website. Broom Hall has a community event with the emphasis on unity in the community. Again, this is the end of July. And there's an introduction to permaculture course. If you don't know, permaculture is a kind of organic gardening plus. It's far more interesting than that. And it's working towards a scheme called Hazelhurst Community Supported Agriculture. Details on the website. Right, various activities going on from Healy City Farm. They're having a series of Family Fuel Busters Fun Days at the Energy House, all about how to improve your environmental awareness. There's a whole series of them throughout August, various dates. And again, I keep saying this, I've got to think of something different to say, but details are on the Alt Sheff website, www.alt-sheff.co.uk. I'd just like to mention that on the first Saturday in each month, a group called Women in Black protest against violence in various forms. And this month, on Saturday, 7th of August, at Barker's Pool in Sheffield, they're protesting against the current rule that in the UK, women who come here from another country on the basis of marriage to a British citizen are not allowed public housing or benefits until their immigration status is regularised. So this means that the women are economically dependent on the spouse or partner. And this obviously causes complications, for example, in the event of violence in the relationship. On a lighter side, 20th of August, a pedal-powered workshop. And guess who it is? I think it's the Mysterious Pixies again.
Oh, got it again.
Yep. Again, and guess what? Location to be confirmed. Meet the bees at Western Park Museum. Find out more about the amazing world of bees. Honey tasting and candle making, if you're into that. Another one I'd like to mention, it's not a Sheffield thing, it's a course at the University of Leeds called an MA in Activism and Social Change. Really interesting course. The people teaching the course are activists themselves, and they encourage anybody from whatever type of activist background they are to come along and have a look. That'll be something to be starting in September, October time, University of Leeds. Mm. I'd just like to mention this. I have been reading about Tesco's and Sainsbury's. If you live in mill houses, you might know that mill houses is going to get an enlarged Tesco and an enlarged Sainsbury's. Mill houses already has 25% pollution above the limits, and of course there's no small traffic problem. Yeah. And they're going to lose what they've got. Yeah. And Wadsley Bridge, lucky old Wadsley Bridge, is going to get 400 full and part-time jobs, over 400 car parking spaces, and so much congestion that they're going to need an extra road to get in their new Sainsbury's megastore. Yeah. Oh great,
ever expanding.
Mm-hmm. There is, just to let people know, a new campaign against the deportation of a woman called Odette Sefuko from Democratic Republic of Congo. She lives in Sheffield. The UK government is trying to send her back to Uganda. Why? Because they don't accept that she is Congolese. She's got a Facebook page. The campaign has been launched this week. It sounds very unfair the way she's been treated so far. Yeah? Last couple of things. If you feel like you're a friendly and welcoming person, you might look at New Roots in Burngreave. It's a quite unique kind of cafe, stroke shop. They need a person, or maybe a couple of people, who are interested in vegetarian, vegan food, fair trade stuff and so on, to help them out. It involves helping people who may not speak English as a first language and may have other problems, but it's a really, I find it a really uplifting kind of place to visit, and if you feel like you've got a few spare hours a week, you might check that out. Mm. Sheffield Social Centre is a group intending to buy a building, and we are putting out an appeal. If anyone has got an idea for a building, doesn't have to be too big, but we are on the lookout. It's difficult with a small group of people to find a building, so can you all keep your eyes open and check out the website and let us know if you spot a spare building that's maybe for sale or maybe not.
And also check the last podcast. There was a section on Sheffield Social Centre in the last podcast if you're interested in knowing what it's about and what they're about.
Final thing this week, I will be keeping an eye on Deacon Dave. For those of you who know this person from Sheffield, he's a long-standing activist for the Palestinian cause. He's now back in Hebron in Palestine, visiting family and friends over there, and he's keeping people in Sheffield informed through a YouTube page called Hebron Voices, all one word. That'll be interesting, and we'll also put some updates on Altshire for people to just kind of see the kind of hassle that Palestinians have living over there, sort of thing that we just wouldn't tolerate here. Okay, old boy.
Nice one, Bob. Thank you very much. See you next month.
Thank you.
We now have some recordings from two anti-deportation campaigns in Sheffield. The campaign against deportation of Odette Sefuko and the protest against the imminently threatened deportation of Lemlem Hussein Abdu. We start with the launch of the campaign against deportation of Odette Sefuko. Odette Sefuko fled the Democratic Republic of Congo via Uganda in fear of her life 5 years ago and came to the UK to claim asylum. The Home Office have rejected her claim, refused to accept she is Congolese and want to send her back to Uganda, a place where she might face imprisonment, torture or maybe death. Her case is now being reviewed by the European Court. The campaign launch started with the screening of the documentary film The Greatest Silence, Rape in the Congo, which documents the plight of women like Odette. We start with an extract from an interview conducted in 2008 by Mike McCormick on Mind Over Matters, with Lisa F. Jackson, producer and director of the film. The full 30-minute interview is available on the A.N. Foss Radio Project at radioforall.net. The website for The Greatest Silence, Rape in the Congo is at thegreatestsilence.org.
The Greatest Silence, Rape in the Congo is about, basically it's about a forgotten women in a forgotten war. For the last 10 or 12 years, there's been a humongous conflict raging in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is in the heart of Africa. And I have been researching and been aware of for years the incredible toll on women and girls in conflict. And the title for the film comes from a UN report that was done years ago that calls violence against women and girls one of history's greatest silences. So I read that report in early 2001 and thought I would do sort of a survey film. I would go to Kosovo, I would go to Sierra Leone, I would go to Burma, I would go to Colombia, I would go to the Congo and look at the fate of women and girls in conflict. And of course, in modern warfare, civilians are intentionally targeted. At the turn of the century, 90% of the casualties were military, and now 90% of the casualties are civilian. And a huge number of those are women and girls who are not killed, they are raped. And they are invisible statistics in modern conflict. So I went to the Congo in 2006, initially just to do, I thought, a little bit of research to find out exactly how bad the problem was. Maybe it was a part of this larger film. But after spending several 3 weeks in the conflict zones in eastern Congo, I realized that this was a story that nobody was telling and that it was a whole film. So I spent a month and a half, 2 months there, actually three months there in 2006.
Can you give us a brief overview of the history of the Congo, kind of how it got to where it is currently?
Well, the Democratic Republic of Congo, we probably remember better as Zaire, was a Belgian colony in the late 1800s and was completely pillaged by King Leopold, who just sacked the country, taking out rubber and ivory and killing half the native population. There are photographs from that era that show guys in pith helmets holding baskets full of hands, because people, you know, if you didn't meet your quota for the rubber barons, your hands were amputated. So it has a huge, long history of just being sacked and desecrated by the First World. It's an incredibly rich country, bordered by 9 different countries, all of whom come across the borders to pillage its incredible resources, which include minerals, petroleum, diamonds, and a mineral called coltan. Coltan is a mineral that without which you cannot make a Sony PlayStation, a remote control, a laptop computer, or a cell phone. And it can be argued that there's the blood of Congolese women on your cell phone. So what is going on now, particularly in eastern Congo, is a resource war, where in the last 10 or 12 years, over 5 million people have died. And when you look at that number, it's 10 Darfurs have happened in the Congo. But it's a war in slow motion. It's an invisible war that it has not gotten the media attention that Darfur has. I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe Darfur is, you know, you can attach the term genocide to Darfur and a lot of people get all excited, and attach George Clooney and that, you know, triples the excitement. But nobody yet is really talking about what's going on in Congo and the First World's complicity in what is going on in Congo. And so I chose to tell the story of that poor conflict-racked country through the voices of its women.
For those of you that haven't met Odette Sifuku, I'd just like to introduce Odette. And she'd just like to say hello.
Thank you very much for everybody for coming, to take your time to come here to support me. God bless everybody. Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming to this launch of the campaign KDOS. The aims of the campaign, you will have picked up, are threefold. Information sharing about difficulties of the current situation for asylum seekers in the UK, despite a history of asylum seekers adding value to this nation. Secondly, information sharing about the current situation for women in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's what we hope to do with the film showing here tonight. And obviously, CADOS stands for the Campaign Against the Deportation of Odette Sifuko. The reason for showing this film is that it gives a powerful insight into the current situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It sets Odette's particular case into context, as it was because of her work as a women's campaigner in the DRC that her life was threatened and she was forced to flee, leaving her children and seeking asylum here in the UK in 2005. So it's been a very long time. The doctor that you see interviewed in the film, named Dennis Makengwe, is the same doctor who helped Odette to escape. So it really is very close to Odette's personal story. I think what this film shows is really shocking, and I felt ill and upset the first time that I saw it, just as I did the first time I heard Odette's story. And although it's a horrific truth that this film shares, I also think it's a really important film that we've watched, as it brings the voices of these Congolese women to our ears.
Lemlem Abdu is a 60-year-old Eritrean woman. She fled Eritrea originally in 1978. So this is a story that goes back for over 30 years. She was a refugee first in Sudan, and after some years she went to Saudi Arabia, where she worked for 20 years as a domestic helper nanny for a Saudi family. From time to time, the Saudi family came to the UK and brought her with them. While she was in their employment, she had a bad accident and broke her leg, which has never properly healed and left her permanently disabled. After she was disabled, the Saudi family stopped paying her wages, and on a subsequent visit to the UK in 2007, they abandoned Lemlem here with no papers and no means of support. She sought asylum in the second half of 2007 in the UK. She was refused, and her asylum support stopped. She became destitute and has lived for almost 2 years with the support of Assist, the Sheffield charity, on subsistence benefits and in supported in minimal housing. So it's a long story, but the basis of the refusal of the asylum claim by the Home Office is that she at one point held an Ethiopian passport, which is not unusual, as Ethiopia and Eritrea have been at war, and for many years Eritrea was annexed by Ethiopia, and having an Ethiopian passport was one way in which Eritreans could travel. So this is the basis, this is the defence that the Home Office are giving, that they say she is Ethiopian. Now, she has never been in Ethiopia. She has no friends or family there. She has no means of support. As a 60-year-old disabled woman, she would be extremely vulnerable. There is very limited health and social care there. So we are extremely concerned for her safety. She returns to Ethiopia.
Deportation, no way!
Deportation, no way!
Deportation, no way!
Deportation, no way!
oppression, no work!
Just to say, you noticed that three of us went in as a delegation because we wanted to meet with the area manager from UK Border Agency just to raise the case. What we did was we just explained the background to Lem Lem's case and updated them on the situation, and he listened to what we had to say, and I think he was genuinely surprised, actually, at just how extreme this situation is, and was also surprised that Lem Lem was still under threat of deportation, even though she's got an application in for a judicial review and we're still waiting to hear whether or not that's been granted. So we just basically updated him and stressed how this was an exceptional case, and he did use the word proportionality, that in his view proportionality was a key issue and that therefore he would be prepared to do something about it in terms of looking in to her case, finding out more, and then contacting the solicitor and contacting Theresa May's office to find out what can be done.
I've been in touch with the offices of both Nick Clegg and Meg Mann today. Nick Clegg has been bombarded with emails, but his office says that although they have made clear to the Home Office that they're aware of the situation, only Lem Lem's own MP, Meg Mann, can actually intervene personally with the Home Secretary, Theresa May. If all the legal avenues fail, then the only possibility of stopping the flight seems to be the Home Secretary, Theresa May, intervening on a personal basis, on a compassionate basis, to ask for the flight to be stopped on compassionate grounds. She can do that, but it's very rare for a Home Secretary to do it. We're entirely reliant on Meg Mann, the MP, making this special plea to her. She's the only one who can. And I've been on the phone to Meg Mann's office today. I'm told that she's not available, that she's in parliamentary questions. I've written a long letter from Sheffield Assist calling on her to do this and making a desperate plea for her to do it. Her office says that they have forwarded this to Meg Mann's in-tray. They can't guarantee that she will access the in-tray tonight because she has a very full programme. I'm inclined to say that any asylum seeker who lives in Meg Mann's constituency, if they have a problem with their asylum claim, move out as soon as possible. Because we've had experience of Meg Mann's office before, and Meg Mann is always making excuses not to intervene in these cases. The British Home Office and the United Kingdom Border Agency are imposing upon the Ethiopians a legal obligation which they don't really want. So it all boils down to the fact that our United Kingdom Border Agency is desperate to deport people when they can, if they can, in order to meet their targets. And I mean, that's a terrible indictment of our asylum system.
Just to say, what is clear is that campaigning is making a difference, because if this campaign had not got off the ground, then there's no doubt that we wouldn't have any response from the MPs, Nick Clegg, or the regional manager in here. And I think, you know, you've got to carry on campaigning. I think that there are a number of possibilities. I really hope that the area manager in there does what he says he's going to do, because he said if there is a judicial review outstanding, then her flight should be suspended and she should be released.
I just want to say as well, I think it's really good that we're here today, because of course Lem Lem went to sign in the monitoring place in there, and when she did, of course, she got taken prisoner. Kidnapped, I think it was. I think it's good that we're here. So every time someone gets taken prisoner and kidnapped by the Borders Agency, they get a demonstration. It's like a dog. You behave badly, you get this. Every time they detain someone and try and deport them, we come here, we make their job harder. It also gives encouragement to a few good people, and there are a few good people, I know them, in that building, who have big questions about the job they're being asked to do. And our presence here gives those people encouragement and arguments to argue with their workmates that the job they're doing is wrong.
We are a gentle, angry people.
Sheffield Indie Radio, because we own the means of production.
All right, then, this next section is on the Deepwater Horizon BP oil spill in the Gulf. We've been wanting to cover this, and I know there's been a bit of saturation level of news coverage in the mainstream media. What we put together for you is mostly from the excellent website democracynow.org, which runs a daily news feed. So interviews from there, really. Uncovering the dirty dealings between Obama and the oil industry, and also BP's disastrous record of ignoring safety warnings. The music at the end of this section is Mos Def, Lenny Kravitz, Tim Robbins, and the Preservation Jazz Orchestra. I think it's a top tune. If you like that tune, go to gulfaid.org. Don't worry, it's not Bono, Sting, Bob, whatever the name is. And the last URL is worth checking out if you want to see the real side of what's going on environmentally, and particularly of the Deepwater Horizon, is ecoshop.org. Check that one out. Yeah, there you go.
Reports that a series of internal BP investigations over the past decade had warned senior BP managers that the oil company repeatedly disregarded safety and environmental rules and risked a serious accident if it did not change its ways.
Through interviews with a number of whistleblowers working particularly in their Alaska operations, and then a series of documents that were leaked to ProPublica, we saw that BP's been grappling with internal cultural problems for many years, for 11 that we looked at going back to 1999. These problems identify a couple of core issues: a lack of accountability among their executives, a lack of ability to hear warnings from their safety inspectors and their maintenance personnel, a pattern of decisions not to upgrade equipment, to run equipment until the last possible moment and eke out the greatest possible profits that they could from that equipment, and a consistent emphasis on production, on profits over safety and environmental compliance. BP has, for a decade now, been under immense pressure and transferred that pressure to its employees. They encouraged the skipping of processes like pressure testing of valves that would control leaks both in pipelines and in compressor stations. They seem to have cut short on what they call coupon tests that measure corrosion inside the pipelines, which have been known to leak. They did not upgrade very old safety systems, including gas sensors and fire sensor alarms, which are actually similar to some of the things that failed on the Deepwater Horizon rig in the Gulf. Each of those might cost $100,000 or $2 million, but on the whole, they've added up to tens of millions of dollars in savings for the company.
Well, President Obama might now have some harsh words for BP, but an extensive new investigation into his administration's handling of the disaster reveals it was government mismanagement, delays, and absence of oversight that allowed the crisis to spiral out of control.
Well, so Obama stood up and said, you know, we take response. The buck stops with me, essentially, is what he said. He said that the reforms at MMS hadn't been urgent enough and that he took responsibility for that. You know, and he said that, you know, my biggest fault was sort of taking the oil companies at their word that they knew what they were doing and had a worst case scenario plan. But as it turns out, that's not just something that Obama should have been taking the word of the oil companies for, but MMS in fact is responsible for reviewing the worst case scenario cleanup plans of these oil companies. And in BP's case, BP talks about protecting walruses in the Gulf in their cleanup plan, and they have a cleanup plan that is supposed to be good for a spill of 250,000 barrels a day, that is to say an Exxon Valdez every day. they claimed the capacity to significantly address the cleanup from a spill of that size, and it's just ridiculous. It's laughable, and so there was no oversight in terms of the cleanup end of this. And then, you know, in terms of so Obama and Salazar take over, they go in eyes wide open, and they say, okay, we know that there's a problem here. And the ownership of this actually starts in sort of an admirable place. Even before Obama took office, he said, you know, this is my great friend Ken Salazar, and he's going to come in and make sure that Interior is much more than a service company for the special interests. And Ken Salazar puts on the white hat and says there's a new sheriff in town, and goes about sort of trying to clean up an agency that had descended into rank criminality, and, you know, oil MMS staff partying with oil staff, oil company officials, and doing drugs with them. The corruption of this agency is really sort of hard to overstate. But what Ken Salazar did, he has a chief of staff who's a former attorney general of Colorado, and they sort of cleaned up the rank criminality bit, but the reform didn't go any farther than that. So they left in place top managers who'd risen through the ranks in this incredibly pro-development oil culture, such that on the day that Ken Salazar announced his reforms of MMS, in the Alaska office, they served a cake that says "Drill, baby, drill" on it. And so the rot at MMS extends far beyond what was a criminal problem, and it goes to managers who only get promoted if they sort of suppress science and fast track drilling, and so that's the culture of this place, and you know, which is a long-standing problem. But they had promised to clean it up, and then. But instead of doing that, they started to just throttle up offshore drilling to unprecedented levels. And, you know, to his credit, when Salazar came into office, he also threw out Bush's plan to open up essentially every coastline in America to offshore drilling. And this was just sort of a last-minute wet dream for the oil companies. It was not a serious proposal, no one expected that to stand. The Bushes put it in the Federal Register either at midnight or after midnight on the day that they left. So this was not anything more than a gesture on their part. And so Salazar, to his credit, took that off the table. But a year later came back with his own plan, which essentially split the baby, and seemed to split the baby along political lines, so that red states were exposed to new drilling and blue states, including the Pacific Coast, were not, and the Atlantic Coast north of New Jersey. And so he and President Obama appear at an Air Force base in front of an F-18 fighter jet and a giant American flag and this sort of stagecraft that had the all the trappings of the mission accomplished photo op, and they said, you know, we've looked at this for a year. This is a hard decision. We've looked at it for a year. We're ready to roll here. And Salazar said, you know, our reforms are working. We have an agency that's capable of handling this. And, you know, then a couple days later, President Obama, unbidden, says, you know, oil rigs are safe. And so they took ownership of this completely right before the disaster, without having implemented any of the substantive reforms that they should have. And so that what that did is it left in place a drilling program that not only it's a complicated issue, but the Bush environmental reviews were structured so that you would have a detailed environmental assessment of the region. An environmental assessment of the individual leasing blocks, and then for each drilling project they would get a categorical waiver, just a get out of environmental review free card. And so the BP drilling site had gone each drilling permit was based on these three levels, and so it said, well, we did the review at the top, and then we did the secondary review and the third tertiary review. We don't have to do because we did the other two reviews, but the other two reviews were crap. They were didn't account for the possibility. They called a blowout a low probability, low risk event, which is, I can understand the low probability part, but the low risk is just absurd. The short story is that they took the Bush's word on the science and then issued the get out of environmental review card free.
All the water don't mix. Petroleum don't go good for no fish. Oh, it ain't my fault. But BP, big pimp, and big problem, bad president. Billionaire pirate, boiling point, first question. Oh, it ain't my fault. Say, man, who pushed the marsh back? It's where the hurricane shelter in the garden at. Oh, it ain't my fault. From the Gulf of Mexico to the broke level wall, something gone wrong and it's somebody off. Oh, it ain't my fault. Skip to say the city, go to the rock and the high day pay to say the rock ride. I don't know how to play. City, go to the rock and the high day pay to say the rock ride. I don't know how to play. City, go to the rock and the high day pay to say the rock ride. I don't know how to play. So, Lord, oh, Lord. It ain't my fault. Rock the hot day face, say the rock ride. I don't know how to play. So to go to the rock the hot day face, say the rock ride. I don't know how to play. So to go to the rock the hot day face, say the rock ride. I don't know how to play. So Lord, 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 hey, my boy.
Somebody described EDL as a drinking club with a website. somebody described EDL as a drinking club with a website. Exactly. The drinking club with a website. Exactly. The drinking club with a website.
I wonder, do you feel alright? I said, do you feel all right? All right at this time.
Yeah, the report there from Newsnight about the EDL. EDL agreeing that they were a drinking club with the website. But we need to ask, who's buying the rounds in that drinking club? And according to The Guardian, it's a character called Alan Lake.
There is power in unity. There is power in unity.
The Guardian also reports Alan Lake as being 45 years old, so on a few points of history, as he was born in roughly 1965. The Chinese Cultural Revolution started in 1964 and ended around 1975 at the same time as the Vietnam War, when Alan Lake was 10 years old. Alan Lake is a fake, and we can show that he's a fake with a small extract of audio from him speaking in Malmo.
When I was a kid, at school, there was loads of Maoists who used to go around threatening people and waving little red books. I used to have my own
little red book to read. And
the thing is, at the time they were doing this in China, in Tibet, China was killing 1 million Tibetans out of a population of 5 million. Now, I was used to being free Tibet, and I was out there demonstrating outside the Chinese embassy and stuff. I never saw any of these people, right? So it was just a fashion, yeah? It was a fashion to demonstrate for Mao's killing.
It's gone.
1 million Tibetans being killed at that time, but well, it doesn't matter about that. And do we go and demonstrate for free Tibet now? No, fashion's gone. And then you had the Vietnam War. Yeah, that was great fashion when I was at university, everybody demonstrating for that.
All right, Alan, so everybody was demonstrating for the Vietnam War when you were at university, apparently, at age 10. So we'd like to point out that Chinese People's Army took control of Tibet in 1951. Most of the killing and fighting was over before Lake was born, and yet he claims to being part of the Free Tibet movement. He mentions that the population of Tibet at that time was 5 million, in fact it was 1.5 million, and that the figure of 1 million killed is an exaggeration. It's an exaggeration that's recognized as such by the founder of the Free Tibet movement, and a fact that Lake, who was apparently outside the Chinese embassy, is totally unaware of. Lake claims he was at school when there was a fashion for Mao's little red book, and at university when the demonstrations against the Vietnam War were going on. The fact that Lake doesn't seem to know is that the fashion for little red books and the Vietnam War were concurrent. In fact, the fashion for little red books was part of the opposition to the American involvement in the Vietnam War. How can he be in two places at once, Alan Lake, age 10, at university and at school at the same time? What a guy. So Alan Lake is a liar, and as we can hear from this next clip, a hypocrite.
Been explained earlier, there is this policy, this doctrine in Islam, and it's authorized, it's in the scripture, it's called taqiyya. And taqiyya means that you're allowed to lie. And the point is that if you're in Dar al-Harb, which is here, this is not Dar al-Islam, Islamic land, this is Dar al-Harb, this is non-Islamic land, then effectively you're at war, because this should be converted to Dar al-Islam. Therefore, effectively, you can always lie.
Yeah, and you are lying, aren't you, Alan? Because you're in Sweden. That's not England. So effectively, you can lie, because you're in a foreign country. Lake is described as a millionaire businessman. There's no way that this man is a millionaire businessman. Anybody with this kind of grip on reality cannot be a millionaire businessman. So this begs the question, who is the millionaire businessman? Well, we just don't know. Lake describes himself as a counter-jihadist. And that begs the question, what is jihad? It's struggle. He struggles against struggle, and he's definitely a struggler. Okay, I can hear the sirens coming on now. We're getting ready to cross the invisible line.
Getting tin foil hats on. We're going to cross the invisible line.
Are you ready to cross the invisible line? Yes. Here we go.
Thank you. Okay, on today's Crossing an Invisible Line, we have Dr. Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, who has worked for the government's Prevent strategy and also advised the British military in Sandhurst. And he's going to tell us about a Al-Qaeda-connected jihadi group in Baluchistan and their connection to the so-called liquid bomb plot. And we can see the involvement here of Western intelligence services with jihadi groups, the sworn enemy of the EDL. Dr. Ahmed.
Now we're going to come up to the contemporary period. What's happening now? From 2005 to 2007, the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Lebanon, Iran, Pakistan, and so on. Now you'll all remember the liquid explosives plot to blow up civilian airplanes across the Atlantic that came to light last year. And I had interviewed a man by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Nigel Wild, an explosives expert, who basically said that you could never actually create liquid explosives in an aircraft and carry out a viable attack. It wouldn't have worked. But I'm not going to talk about that dimension. I'm going to talk about another dimension, which is the official story of this plot. Now, both US and British officials, in their eagerness to find some kind of an international dimension, named the mastermind of this plot. They said, his name is Mathieu Rahman, the emir of an Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist group called Jundala, based in Pakistan, in fact, to be more precise, in Baluchistan, on the disputed border between Iran and Pakistan. Now, apparently, several of the British suspects who were arrested, it was reported, they were members of a UK-based group here, formerly known as Al-Muhajirun, and they reportedly received explosives training in Jundala camps in Pakistan. Now, according to a 2006 report from the South Asia Analysis Group, which is an Indian think tank, and they were reviewing all the mainstream reporting on this, and they basically said, well, basically it's four or five of those guys detained by the police in connection with this liquid explosives plot. Apparently they'd gone to Pakistan after the earthquake in October 2005. They went to do humanitarian relief work in camps run by one extremist group, Jamaat ul-Dawa, and then this group, Jundala, this means Army of Allah, a pro-Al-Qaeda organization, took them to its training camp and trained them in the fabrication and use of explosives and dropped them back in the Quake relief camp. Now, there's kind of slight problem here, you know. There's always this kind of desire to kind of pin it on an outside entity. You could be skeptical, but let's take it at face value. The problem is that Jundala, according to ABC News, has been secretly encouraged and advised by American officials since 2005, according to US and Pakistani intelligence sources, speaking to ABC News. With covert US backing, according to ABC News, funneled through the Pakistani ISI and the Gulf states, Jundala is carrying out terrorist attacks inside Iran. The operation has been approved by Vice President Dick Cheney and Pakistani President General Musharraf, the man who is supposedly waging a war against the terrorists in the Red Mosque. Quoting ABC News, a senior US government official said groups such as Jundala have been helpful in tracking Al-Qaeda figures and that it was appropriate for the US to deal with such groups in that context. The Americans have also been flying covert reconnaissance flights inside Iranian airspace to aid such terrorist bombing raids, according to former Chief UN Weapons Inspector and Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter. These guys are operating under the remit of a covert operation with the highest authority of the US government, and that is the group being backed by the Bush administration that is being, according to the official story put out by the Brits, that has been linked to this phony liquid explosives plot. Phony because it would never have worked.
A bitter class war. It should be understood to be a real war, and it's not a new war, it's an old war. Furthermore, it's a perfectly conscious war everywhere, but specifically in the United States, where there happens to have a highly class conscious business class, and always has, and they have long seen themselves as fighting a bitter class war, except they don't want anybody else to know about it.
You're listening to Bollocks Chat on Sheffield Indie Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the second edition of Bollocks Chat. Got old boy and Chris again, and myself, and what are we going to chat about this time?
Lenin's goal.
No,
at some point in the future we may well talk about Lenin's goal.
Lenin's goal,
or lack of
research.
Or lack of it, but not for tonight.
Not for tonight?
No.
Fine. I noticed that William Hague announced in Kabul that they're spending £200 million on job creation in Afghanistan.
It's good of them.
It's good of them, isn't it? Mm. Good of us, taxpayers.
Mm.
Those of us who pay taxes.
I don't think we're going to get by without talking about the EDL and recent events in Sheffield that might lead us to talk about the EDL. I'm sure there'll be a link on the whatever it is that we advertise this stuff on to an article about recent events regarding the EDL in Sheffield.
The invasion
will be an apt description, I think.
An inundation of the EDL into a Sheffield indie media.
Indeed. Our good friends over at Indie Media.
Yeah. What's going on there then?
What's going on there? What's it all about?
What's that about then?
Well, I think that is about taking the piss. Really, right. I think that's what that particular crew of people are about.
Just taking the piss.
Just taking the piss. Not taking the piss in the sense of having a laugh, but taking the piss in wandering around and doing what they want. I think that's what they're about, and that might be seen as intimidation or taking the piss, but either way, I've been around in Sheffield for years, and I can't remember organised right-wing activists turning up at any meetings.
No.
To have a discussion or not, do you know what I mean? Whatever it is that they're there for. And I understand that certainly one of the guys that was there was giving it the "we're not racist" kind of argument, really. It seems a long way on a piss wet through night to come and tell us,
So
activist type people, that we're not racist.
Know what the fuck the EDL are about then? Why the EDL? They're not racist. Because they don't like a religion.
Why? I don't know.
They are right wing.
They're right wing. Yeah, for sure.
Fascist, you think?
We were talking a bit earlier. I would describe them as sort of very classically fascist. Not Nazi. And I think the Nazi tag don't really stick particularly well. These aren't swastika waving jackbooted skinheads. That's not what they're about, and neither are they the slimy vote for me BNP types.
Uh-huh.
Although clearly it's a fertile ground, isn't it?
There's a crossover.
Yeah, but I think much more importantly that they're an organised group of people. I think maybe we should talk about who organises them, where the money comes from, who pays for our friends to
the fake, the fake Alan Lake.
Yeah, well, somebody's paying for our friends to wander around the north of England invading meetings.
Yeah,
they might be doing that out of their own pocket. I don't know, but I can't see a significant amount of petrol. But yeah, I think my thought is that they are classically fascist and that they are ultra-nationalist, anti-working class, i.e. anti-left, trade unions, you know, that kind of approach. I mean, again, my understanding is they were calling people commies at the meeting.
Yeah.
Not sure, but I'm not sure there were any commies at that meeting.
Well, like, you wouldn't have thought at an indie media meeting, which is supposed to be non-hierarchical, that there would be communists, seeing as communism is inherently hierarchical.
Don't start with Lenin again.
Lenin's gold. Remember. Just look it up on the internet. Lenin's gold. Let's just do a search. Yeah,
but I mean,
find it all.
I don't know who is running them then. Who, you know, I think there's two issues, isn't there? Who's running them is important.
Okay.
And what we knew about
them. I've got my theories.
Kick us off then.
Okay, I'll kick us off with who it is. I'm going to go for people like Lord Pearson, UKIP, who's in the insurance business. That kind of, I'm not saying Lord Pearson funds, but it's kind of that area. I think it's not state, I think it's more financial. It's kind of, you know, the way the CIA connected to Wall Street. Well, I think MI6 had the same relationship with the city, and I think it's distraction and dividing rule coming from that area, the financial people. I mean, Alan Lake mentions UKIP, that you shouldn't join the BNP. It'd be better if you went off a UKIP, because they're better on immigration.
I'm sure that's true.
I'm
not sure that's true. I'm sure they're pretty much exactly the same.
In terms of better from a right-wing perspective on immigration is what I mean. I don't mean I endorse the UK immigration policy. So I think there is a kind of it's that area. It's not state. I don't think. That's just what I think. Just looking at it.
I think one interesting thing is the extent to which they support the current imperial war on terror and their demonisation of Islam is, you know, one of the things that's kind of that the clash of civilizations has been built on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also they disrupted a Palestine solidarity campaign street store in Birmingham.
Yeah.
As well as the Sheffield indie media meeting that they disrupted. That wasn't the first. They'd done a similar thing to a Leeds Anarchist Federation meeting called About the EDL just a week or so before. And there was a while before that, there was a in Newcastle, there was a United Against Fascism meeting that they kind of they turned up at. So you know, there's a this is new. I mean, this is like we are entering a kind of new period of you know how people on the left are going to have to operate, you know, because we haven't had right wingers kind of turning up for disrupt meetings for decades
since the 1920s,
yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. So you know, I mean, and so. You know, is this part of a new strategy of tension? You know, trying to we're facing the biggest kind of economic collapse for you know decades and decades.
Strategic trenches. I'm off.
We've got, you know, peak oils kind of fighting at the heels of the economic collapse at the moment. The kind of demand is going down quicker than the supply is going down, but the supply looks like it's started to go down. We're facing, you know, there's billions being transferred to the banks, and now they're trying to take these billions out of the public sector with NHS privatisations.
Voluntary and community groups, the big society. What is that? That is, let's pay any taxes and just let people volunteer to run state services.
Offload cuts onto community groups.
I think you've got to understand them as a whether we think they're state or financial services run. I think you've got to understand them as part of that response to what's happening.
They're clearly being assisted by the police on their demos, and they're getting bussed around the country. And the way that some of the demos have been policed, the police have there's one in Cardiff where it's been reported that the police basically kind of escorted them around the town centre on a pub crawl, while the anti-racist campaigners were kept in behind a steel pen.
Yeah. Have you got the web address for that story?
Yeah, I'll dig it up and stick it on the web page for the show.
Okay.
And about the Birmingham and the other meetings. Mm.
Yeah, so I think I think financial services, you know, as I said, CIA, Wall Street, they're like that. And so I think the intelligence services will be getting told what to do, how to operate this from financial services. They'll be feeding the police information, basically.
There's a public order unit. Is it the public order unit or the Home Office that Searchlight have reported have been kind of advising ministers that they should be allowing these protests to go ahead?
Yeah.
The EDL protests.
Another
thing, this is kind of going back to the strategy of tension kind of idea, is Al-Majah Haroon, who's kind of front groups Islam for All, Muslims Against Crusades and so on, you know, they've got a long history of having links with various intelligence agencies, and all the kind of the plots that they've been involved in a lot of the fake terror plots
The intelligence.
And the kind of media coverage of, say, Al-Majahroun's stunts and the EDL stunts, you know, again, it's like it's almost like the story's kind of been written beforehand and they're just getting the footage, you know, to fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm.
So the evidence I've got to really, this very scant evidence, has brought the idea that it is finance rather than state in terms of who's doing it. Is a Newsnight thing about the EDL, where they were following about and they met some potential backers in an East End.
Yeah, club. I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. And one of them was described as an IT consultant from a city bank. So how do a bunch of Luton Town footy fans know an IT consultant from a city bank? It seems like a strange bedfellow.
I mean, I know what you're saying, and yet again it still fits with that the classic rise of fascism, doesn't it? You know, and I'm talking pre-Germany, I'm talking Italian, rise of Italian fascism and the organisation of you know, elements of the working class who aren't, I mean, again, we were talking about this, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there was a different pole of attraction for working class people, and that were trade unions and community organisations. Yeah. And in Sheffield, on Park or anywhere there were tenants associations that had Labour Party members or Communist Party members or various shades of left. Yeah. And that were a sort of structure within society.
Yes.
That was an alternative pull to right-wing ideas.
Mm-hmm.
That's been fucked. I mean, Thatcher's project fucked and atomised working class communities to the point where generation on generation aren't had a job, aren't had any fucking prospects.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about the EDL, I think it's important to understand where they come from, but it's also important to understand the actual threat. I mean, I live in quite a white area, and I haven't done for years, but I moved there recently.
Mm-hmm.
Working class estates, council housing, fuck all prospects. Unfortunately, whether they're funded, as I think they probably are, by city bankers at the leadership level, for sure.
Yeah.
But bottom, I mean, this could be damaging. Do you know what I mean? To communities. And classically, I mean, we've already, you were saying, Chris, weren't you, about postings about commies and trade unionists doing anti-British things, like anarchism is anti-British.
Yeah.
Being a trade unionist is a bad, you know, is an anti-British thing. Well, these don't take much to move on from the Burka and Sharia law to commies on the picket line to, do you know what I mean? And I suppose that's...
Well, that's why they went to Sheffield and New Media, isn't it? They see them as lefty.
Well, I'm
yeah.
There's been a lot of coverage of the EDL on indie media, and it's not clear where all of it's coming from, and some of it is strange. It's greatly exaggerating the threat from the EDL.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's written kind of in opposition to them. But, you know, some of these... there's a high volume of these articles. They get a high volume of comments. There's a lot of trolling. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, there's some EDL supporters posting stuff. And it almost seems like it's... they're kind of being wound up.
Yeah.
There's some of these postings, you know, I'm sure... are just being done kind of wind.
There was one that was something like Bradford EDL Armageddon or something. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Which is just like, yeah, I know what you mean. British. Yeah, Armageddon, exactly what I would call the EDL.
So who would want to kind of wind stuff up with, you know, kind of the EDL and indie media? Well, you know, it might be that there's people.
You're listening to Bollocks Chat on Sheffield Indie Radio.
There's been, you know, photos of kind of people from Facebook and stuff like that. Are the people running the EDL message boards able to kind of identifying who, you know, is involved and then using this information to kind of wind stuff up?
Definitely. Strategy, attention, divide and rule.
And do the EDL understand how indie media works? And I suspect they don't, in as much as anyone can post articles.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the vast majority of this content about the EDL, you know, isn't coming probably, I don't think, from kind of regular indie media contributors. And it's definitely not coming from the people running the website.
There's been some criticism of the UAF, which I've seen. I can't remember exactly what it was about.
Well, they are SWP controlled.
So going back to Lennon's book, and
I mean, I hear and have read loads of stuff.
I'm not, I guess, there's people involved in them.
I think anybody who's prepared to get out and stand up and say something about the EDL, sort of power to them, and I won't want to be critical of them.
However, the kind of United Against Fascism kind of approach to fascist standing in elections has been, you know, it's basically been vote Labour.
Oh, for sure.
And this whole kind of, I think the left are kind of responsible for, to some degree, for the ability for the likes of the EDL and the BNP to kind of gain ground, in as much as just advocating support for establishment parties when people are totally disillusioned with all the establishment parties and everything that's going on. It's clearly completely useless. It's like what are the left doing going out campaigning to support the establishment?
Totally. And yet, a kid I know who lives up our end is not an SWP member, is not a UAF member as far as I'm aware, do you know what I mean? But he was out doing some activity with what he described as anti-fascism, which I would say that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
And I suppose my problem with the left of the left, which is us, I suppose, anarchists and the like, is all I ever see is fucking name calling and no organisation, no thought put into, in my area, how do you make sure there's a different pole of attraction to the EDL for white working class disenfranchised?
Yeah,
lads and lasses, do you know what I mean?
All of these fears that are feeding, you know, like on the Star, the headline on the Daily Star yesterday was burqas banned in Muslim country, and it's that mainstream media hysteria that's driving that attraction. That's where they're getting their information from. And then the EDL come along and say, you know, none of the main parties are going to do anything, even the BP, BN, what they call the BNP?
BPP.
The BPP.
You're listening to Bollocks Chat on Sheffield Indie Radio.
Scott, you know
it's... No, you're right, but of course... Uh-huh. The EDL's ideology fits nicely with the Daily Mail and the Daily Star and the Sun. And
even that Newsnight thing, they went to some professor in Manchester University, supposed to be an expert on the right. But there's no kind of understanding of where they come from. They just reported, oh, here they are, they wear balaclavas in Luton.
Yeah.
They meet city bankers in East End pubs. But no kind of, you know, where's it coming from or any kind of analysis of it. It's just this, what do? Do we ignore it or do we let the police deal with it for us?
That's standard media fodder, isn't it?
Analysis.
I mean, that's not... I think, you know, people like us need to be doing the analysis, don't we? On the ground, thinking about, so what do we do about it? But shit, you know, they've turned up and disrupted a lovely meeting. It's not fucking on. But it's not on. It isn't on, and I think that's when I read through some of the comments on the Sheffield Indie Media site. People are just being twats, you know, name calling.
Yeah.
No. We're better anarchists than you. And
well,
mate.
Yeah.
A lot of them disappear.
Well,
very quickly as well. But understandably so.
I mean, some of the name calling, like. The criticism of Leeds AFED over the anti-EDL meeting they held that was invaded by the same kind of group of EDL people. Well, at least the ringleader was the same.
Did you mean underclassrising.net?
Underclass snoozing, as I like to call it.
You're listening to Bollocks Chat on Sheffield
Indie Radio.
I suppose what I would like the response to have been is, right, what are we doing about it then?
Right.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
From anybody, I'm not bothered in.
Yeah.
Who says it? But what are we doing about it? And I know there is stuff happening about it, for sure, and those people who are at the indie media meeting are doing stuff about it. But what happened to the left in Sheffield then? Where are we? What are we doing?
Atomised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not advocating the rebirth of the left or anything like that. I'm just saying, shit, this has happened in Sheffield.
Yeah. I'm quite optimistic about Sheffield as a city, because I think there is there is that socialist, communist. But there is that, it's there. It's there in Sheffield. And other cities. It's still there. It's kind of.
Yeah.
It's kind of in the culture.
You know, whatever your strategy is for organising resistance to all aspects of the shit crisis that we're going to be going through, whether that's
the whole basis of their ideology, if you can even call it that. You know, Alan Lake is an intellectual pygmy. You know, he contradicts himself all the time. You know, he says one thing at one point, oh, it's all, you know, the fog, which means that, you know, looking at Islam as a whole is like a very difficult lifetime consuming thing to do. Well, you have to read the Quran, and then you have to read the Sunnahs or whatever they're called, and then you have to read the Hadith, and it's all very confusing. So don't bother, he says, don't bother. And then he goes on to say, you know, he says it's a multi-threaded, and by the time if you try and untangle all these threads, then you just, you know, you're never going to get anywhere. And then later on he says, oh, it's just this monoculture. Islam, you know, represents a quarter of the planet's population, and it's this monoculture, and it's like top down, it's like an authoritarian as one, and that describes fucking Catholicism, not Islam. You know, there's a Pope, and he tells you that you can't use condoms, and that you can't have abortions, and that women can't be priests, and all the rest of it, you know, and they hide the fact that there are paedophile priests, and yet the EDL don't mind that. That's all okay, and it's a
Catholic division.
So it's a condemnation of all organized religion is what you need. That is an unprejudiced standpoint, not just picking on one organized religion and saying, "Oh, it's taking over the world." It's just complete and utter bollocks, and most people, I hope, would know that.
and it's no coincidence that the majority of the world's remaining oil supplies are in Muslim countries.
80% of the world's remaining oil supplies are in Muslim countries, yeah. You know, no surprise. If it was in Buddhist countries, it would be the threat of Buddhism, Buddhist terrorists, you know.
They do exist.
They do.
In Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka.
It's a shame.
JVP. There's a Buddhist Marxist terrorist.
Aren't there?
Interestingly enough.
But what?
That's another story. So fuck them, and
they're stupid.
They are. I mean, the other thing is that I spoke to somebody at work about it this week, and they were saying, why don't you talk to them about stuff then?
Yeah,
and I think it is quite an interesting proposition, really, because when you were saying, you know, that most people who go on EDL demonstrations haven't got any ideology at all.
No.
Do you know what I mean? They're turning up with a jumble of Daily Mirror, Daily
fear.
Star, and fear.
Fear these people who
and some, like, I don't know, some idea of what England is. I'm not altogether sure what that is, but it's probably something to do with drinking beer and takeaways and having the ability to wear short skirts and all that sort of stuff, which is this kind of amorphous idea of what
English culture is.
You know, it's certainly not my culture, particularly. Well, at all.
Yeah.
Particularly the wearing short skirts thing.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Something that years ago. but yeah, there's no ideology to it, and that's where you can have discussions with people, but not on EDL demos.
No.
Well, and that's about being, I suppose, like Bob from Old Sheffield were talking about being active in the community. knowing your community and your community knowing you, not hiding what you think about.
I've been
a bit of an argy-bargy, but aren't they taking over the world? Well, like, I think more eloquently than I could have put that your sort of argument about Catholicism, absolutely.
All organised religion.
I'm opposed to radical Islam and radical anything. I am an anarchist, therefore.
Yeah.
I'm an atheist, and therefore I'm opposed to religion.
Yeah. And talk about the fundamentalist Christians in America. I mean, if they want Armageddon
in our own city.
Yeah.
Jesus Army.
Yeah.
And they're praying. Do you know what I mean? There are lots of examples.
Yeah.
But the whole, you know, it's a bit of a number. Are you against terrorist bombers who will come and kill your family? It's not a platform to organise around, is it?
No.
Ultimately. And I think the ideology is developing in the terms of commies and reds and trade unionists and all these un-British types.
Yes.
So I'm proud to be un-British.
There's the gay angle as well.
Well, they've got some gay members, but then again, don't forget German National Socialist Workers' Party.
Yeah.
Strasser.
Full of gays.
Well, until a certain night when lots of them were killed. But that doesn't. Gays can be right wing too. Do you know what I mean? It's not a prerogative.
I'm like.
Surely that's only speculation.
Sorry, it is, yeah. I do think he is gay.
But surely that's only speculation.
It is total speculation. I can speculate in my Arab boys, you know, in Morocco. That's so total speculation.
Total speculation on your part.
On my part.
So is anyone going to uncover who he actually is? Because this doesn't seem to be his real name, is it?
He's not Alan Lake. No. Well, he might be Alan Lake.
And Google
Alan Lake businessman and see what you come up with. And
what do you come up with?
You come up with EDL and a Swedish video.
Really?
Where he... Well, I'm interested in that. Yeah, where he puts over his ideas, which are, as I say, totally contradictory, and
as we heard earlier.
But he loves Arab culture. He mentions the fact that gays should join the EDL, but they probably won't because they're having too much fun partying. So that's where the source of my speculation is. That speech, and that's what you get if you Google Alan Lake businessman. You get EDL, you might get a Guardian article, you get and the Swedish talk, nothing else. No Alan Lake opens supermarket or
businessman of the year.
Yeah, millionaire businessman Alan Lake gives lecture on how to con people out of cash successfully or whatever.
Interesting.
Fascinating. Have we got enough?
I'm going.
Got a bollocks chat?
I'm going.
You're going? Cheers, you're
again. That's me, done. I'm going, bye.
That corporate media is irrelevant to working people in this country, 90% of us who work for a living, and to democracy. It has become irrelevant. They want to treat us like we're mushrooms. They want to raise us in the dark and feed us a lot of manure. That's how they raise mushrooms.
Sheffield Indie Radio, because we are the means of production.
We can be the media. Be the media. We'll be right back.
and learn from this, it's possible that within a few years, and allow them to live. It's possible that within a few years, and allow them to live.
mind is a system of organs of computation designed by natural selection to solve the kinds of problems our ancestors faced in their foraging way of life. In particular, understanding and outmaneuvering objects, animals, plants, and other people.
Sheffield Indie Radio, because we own the means of production.
Yeah, that's right, we own the means of production, so we're producing. This has been the second podcast of Sheffield Indie Radio Collective. Thanks for listening. And goodbye.
Never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.